You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Today we have a special guest. He's a good friend, but he means a lot to people all around the world, all around the country because of his work. Some people know him as the Dean of Columbia's Journalism School. Other people know him as a writer, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. Other people know him as somebody who's come up in hip-hop music and culture. They know him as a historian on race politics. They know him for the documentaries he's been a part of and helped put forth. They know him as a frequent guest on numerous talk shows. His name is Jelani Cobb, and he is in the building this afternoon to talk about a brand new book that he has, and it is called Three or More is a Riot. And I'm gonna say this before we even start talking, Jelani. There are books, and then there are books, and then there are books. And this is a book of books. Considering the moment that we're in, where history is being erased, and me knowing you the way I know you, I forget that you are a historian. So I guess one of my first questions is, do you see yourself more as a historian or a journalist? That's one of the questions I want to ask you. But this book, Three or More is a Riot, and it's the subtitle is Notes on How We Got Here, 2012 to 2025. You picked an era to really focus on, but as I'm reading this, I'm forgetting that you're really covering a short period of time because it is so full of history. And I'll just close with this. You know, Chuck D said, I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. And yeah. You don't write for the sake of just, you know, every word is, it's almost like a Public Enemy album. It's like, damn, I forgot about that. I forgot about that. Oh, let me go look this up. It is, man, this is a book. Salute to you, my brother. This is.
I appreciate that. Thank
you. Yeah. So let's talk about this. And I guess, you know, Three or More of the Riot. What is this about?
So you really did a great job of encapsulating, you know, what this book was supposed to do. And first, I want to say thank you, you know, for having me on, and also thank you to you for the work that you've been doing for so many years. You know, being a voice that raised concerns, you know, that the community was feeling, but you couldn't necessarily get out there, you know. And so that's, you know, a part of a vital, crucial part of the progressive media tradition, of the Black media tradition, of, you know, the pro-democracy, you know, media tradition. So all those things, I think that, you know, you are an exemplar, you know, of that. And so I'm very, you know, honored and happy to be here with you as always. The book, you know, so we have been having this conversation. And I say we, I mean, people of conscience, people who are concerned, having this conversation about how we got here and, you know, what happened, you know, what were the things that we didn't see that allowed us to come to a moment where, you know, we have masked agents roaming the streets and, you know, with full license from the Supreme Court now to racially profile people, that we have universities being, you know, extorted into bending to the will of the White House. The academic freedom, you know, has been jeopardized and threatened. That, you know, we're seeing gerrymandering in between censuses. It's like not even like the annual kind of the decennial, you know, redrawing of district lines. It's just district lines being redrawn willy-nilly to try to preserve the prerogatives of one man. You know, we could go on. You know, Black history being banned, you know, history itself being erased, the Smithsonian under attack. And so the more I thought about it, the more we were talking about these things happening in the present, the more they reflected upon particular dynamics that had shown themselves in the time period that, you know, since I've been writing for The New Yorker, which is 2012. The first thing that I ever wrote for The New Yorker, you know, when I was talking with, you know, my editor, Amy Davidson, she, you know, suggested, she was like, yeah, there's this story out of Florida, you know, can you look into it and see, you know, what's going on? And, you know, the story of a homicide in which there had been no arrests, despite people being clear about, you know, who had committed the homicide. And, you know, I thought, surely there has to be some more complication to this. You know, I started digging around a little bit. And no, it turns out that it is. Like, this person has shot an unarmed 17-year-old, and they have not suffered any legal consequences for it at the time. And, of course, that 17-year-old was named Trayvon Martin. And, you know, my editor said fatefully, why don't you follow this story or keep up after I filed the first one? She said, why don't you just keep track of where this story goes? I'm still following this story. I'm still, it's like, you know, how people talk about the echoes of the Big Bang, you know, that with the proper equipment, you can discern, you know, still bouncing around out in the universe. It's like, that was such a fundamental moment. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, in some ways came out of that. Dylann Roof, who killed 9 people in the basement of the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and also became a kind of martyr slash hero, you know, for people on the ultra far right. He was responding, if you read his manifesto, he was responding to what he took to be the bias in the Trayvon Martin case and the prosecution of George Zimmerman. So all of this stuff begins in this moment, and we can kind of see it's the tributaries, you know, the things that come downstream from it, all the way out to the kind of radical insanity that we're dealing with now. And so I thought that putting together the collection would be a good way of getting at all of those themes.
Now, I've read a lot of your writings over the years, but to see them all in one spot is something else. Mm-hmm. Each piece can be a lesson onto itself. And I'm going to say this very humbly, you know, when it officially comes out, you know, my kids are going to have to read a chapter a day because it is so rich with history. And I'll start off with the Trayvon Martin. It's not just the Trayvon Martin story. Mm-hmm. It is you being a witness and going down there and doing a story. So little things that we may have forgotten, like, for example, that Zimmerman wasn't immediately arrested. Mm-hmm. Many people forget about that. What was going on, the circus around it. But then all of a sudden, you're also bringing into the fact that Obama's in office and, you know, and it was an Oscar Grant case. And so you give us immediate history, you give us a long history, and then you're telling us what is actually happening, which, one, is kind of unusual at a time when people want things quick, fast, in a hurry, and they don't really do the due diligence. It's not a soundbite type of thing, but it's something that you can read, and it's almost necessary to fully understand the complexity of what you're writing about. You read about Trayvon Martin, now you can go, whoa, this makes sense. It's not just a 17-year-old kid that got shot. It's standing on this history. So as a historian, how are you able to balance that with being a journalist that's digging deep for the story, and then being able to platform that at a time when people go, we don't need this history. Just, you know, give us the story, Jelani.
You know, it's interesting because it's become more crucial and more obvious that we have to ground, you know, the work that we're doing in an understanding of history. And so I've doubled and tripled down on this. I now teach a course at Columbia called American History for Reporting. And, you know, that's because we have to be able to look at what's going on around something. So, for instance, we had all this conversation about, you know, the Sanford County Courthouse, which is where the trial of George Zimmerman was held. And, you know, I remembered that in Sanford County, in 1951, couple who were the Mims County NAACP, they bid the founders of them, you know, Harry Moore and Harriet Moore, and they were teachers, you know, who had been fired from their jobs for their advocacy for equal pay for black and white teachers in the state of Florida. The state of Florida fired them for that. They went on to become full-time organizers for the NAACP. They organized a voting rights campaign. And, you know, they'd organized black voters, including black voters in Sanford County. And as a consequence of their actions, on Christmas morning, 1951, their home was firebombed and both of them were killed. Harry Moore died immediately. Harriet Moore died, I think, about a week later in a hospital in Sanford County. And so that was anchored there. It wasn't like we emerged in some pristine moment that had no racial context, you know, whatsoever. Like, that was buried history that was right there, contextualizing the things we were dealing with when Trayvon Martin came up. So we have to understand that.
But how do you remember all that or get into that? Do you go into looking into a history? Do you go, oh, I'm in Sanford, what's the history? Or is this something that you, as, you know, Jelani Cobb, just knows, you know, comes up kind of automatically, and then you contextualize it? Because that is not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not an easy thing to do, but I think you have to care enough to try it. So sometimes it happens, you know, in either of those two ways. You know, sometimes there'll be something that will just jump out to me and like, okay, I remember this, and that this is connected to this, and these things happen. Other times there are things that I have to kind of delve into. And, you know, for instance, when I was covering the trial of Dylann Roof, I found that in 1947, there had been a lynching in South Carolina and that the New Yorker had covered it. And it was an extensive coverage of the trial. And so I found my work in, I think that was 2017, 2018, to be in dialogue with this long piece that the New Yorker had published, you know, 60 years before, 70 years before. And, you know, that was just for me doing my research, you know, on the subject. And so it's like, okay, so what's the difference between then and now? What are the dynamics? What are the commonalities? And, you know, sometimes I'll work backward in that way as well.
The title of your book is rooted in history as well. Mm-hmm. And obviously that was very intentional. Let's talk a little bit about that. Why it was important to title the book the way that you did.
So the title, you know, Three or More is a Riot, is, it actually came to me, interestingly enough, when I was in South Carolina working on, you know, the story about the trial. And it occurred to me that, you know, there had been, after the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina, I believe that was in 1739, if I remember correctly. But there had been a revolt that galvanized the enslaved people in South Carolina and pushed them, you know, in an attempt to get to their freedom. And as a result of that, the colonial legislature passed a law that said the definition of a slave revolt was more than two Negroes outside the company of a white man. And so no matter what you were doing, you know, you could have been praying, you could have been eating, you could have been talking, but unless you had the presence of a white man, that was considered to be insurrectionary. And, you know, that also kind of translated later into the civil code, where a lot of, you know, states will have and municipalities will have their legal definition of a riot, which is public mayhem committed by three or more people. You know, if it's two of you, you're just wilding out. If it's three of you, then it actually fits the legal definition of a riot. And so I was thinking about the political nature of being black and the political nature of being black in association with each other. And so I thought about the people who I'd interviewed all the time, over all that time, the people whom I profiled, the stories. And so they kind of became this collective of people that were, you know, all together in some way, shape, or form. And it was, you know, three or more as a riot.
Well, the history is rich. And as I said, throughout the book, you know, you forget that you're covering, you know, 2012 to 2025. Because you're really giving us the scope of American history up and down, and with all the nuances and subtleties and sharp contradictions and glaring omissions, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to pick out one of my favorite passages. I shouldn't say passages, just the way that it's sequenced. But there's a part in there where you talk about the movie Django.
Yeah.
You juxtapose that with Lincoln, and in that you talk about Inglourious Basterds, right? And I mean, that man is so rich with history and dishistory that I was like, you know, I had to read that like three or four times. It was like a record. Like, let me read that again. Let me read that again. It wasn't because I didn't understand it, but there was so much stuff I had not thought about as it was coming. Some things I had. I remember when you wrote the Lincoln article, because I think we might have even had you on, because there was so much omissions. But when you couched it the way you did, especially with Django, then it was like, whoa. So let's talk a little bit about that sequence of chapters.
Yeah. You know, what was interesting about it, about first off with the Tarantino thing, is I never got as much pushback early on as I got about that. Like, there were a lot of, surprisingly, there were a lot of black people who were really upset with me for the criticism I made of Django Unchained. And to back up, you know, to what we were talking about with Inglourious Basterds, there was a really interesting moment, you know, that came about, you know, in relationship to that movie, which is that I was in Moscow. I spent a semester in Moscow, teaching at Moscow State University. And when I was there, I got into a conversation with a group of Russians who were very mindful and very interested in American popular culture. And the film Inglourious Basterds came up. And one thing that you have to understand contextually is that, you know, culturally, Russians to this day feel that the world has never adequately acknowledged the sacrifices that they made in order to defeat Hitler. You know, it's like 26 million Russians died in the course of World War II. And
26 million.
Very few people know that. Very few people know that. If you want to see probably the most gangster single image I've ever seen in my life, was when I visited the Red Army Museum. There's this giant screen image, and, you know, it's taken in the course of World War II, in the most dire moment, when the Nazi army is about 60 miles outside of Moscow. And the caption says, "Soviet citizens dig trenches ahead of the expected German invasion of Moscow. That doesn't convey. When it says Soviet citizens, these are 50, 60, 70-year-old women with shovels.
Wow.
And it was that every single Russian was prepared to die before they let the Germans into that city. It's just incredible. And you understand what was at stake, because the point was that, you know, Hitler wanted to liquidate the Soviet Union. I mean, liquidate its population. And so they were like, there's no disincentive for fighting. We either die fighting or we die after the fighting is over. So we choose the fight.
Was mm-hmm. Russia a beacon, you know, for many countries the way that it was during the Cold War, you know, like communism
sure.
and all that?
Sure. People
saw. Was it one of those places like you take down Russia, you're taking down a whole lot of, you know, other places?
Yeah, people saw. So first off, I mean, Hitler's strategy, you know, in terms of the Soviet Union was that, you know, the thing that, I mean, all sorts of like problems that, you know, endemic in the Soviet system, but Hitler recognized the massive agricultural potential that it had. And he planned for the Soviet Union to be basically the breadbasket of his European empire. But the problem is that there were already people there who were eating that bread. So you had to get rid of those people. And you had to keep around just enough of them to produce the agricultural needs, to meet the agricultural needs of his empire. That was the kind of grand plan. And so the thing there is that to this day, Russians feel they feel a way about the fact that no one has ever recognized their particular role in, you know, defeating the Nazi army. Fast forward to me having this conversation about Django, about this conversation about Inglourious Basterds, which imagines a world in which Hitler is killed with the assistance of American soldiers, but is killed by a Jewish theater owner and in the, you know, the course of the war. And when I was talking with the students, and someone said, what did you think of Inglourious Basterds? And I said, oh, I loved it. I thought it was amazing. And I immediately knew I had said the wrong thing. Everybody was quiet. And so someone said, but Professor, this is not how Hitler died. And I said, oh, no, I know. You know, Hitler died. He committed suicide because the Red Army, you know, was close to finding him. You know, it was the pressure that the Soviet Army had placed upon him that led him to commit suicide. But this is, you know, Tarantino's film is just an alternate version of history. And so this student said something to me that was, to this day, one of the most direct ways of me knowing that I had to concede an argument. He said, but Professor, how can people engage with an alternate history if they have never been willing to engage with the actual history? And I was like, oof. I said, you're right.
100%. That's Black America right here.
Bingo. So when I look at Django Unchained, and this is his alternate history of slavery, I was like, but we won't grapple with the actual history of slavery. I mean, we're still dealing with this now. They're trying to diminish the extent to which the Smithsonian deals with the trial and the tribulation and the ordeal of human bondage in this country. And so if we have a country that's reluctant to grapple with the actual history, how in the world can we glorify an alternate history, a fictional version of history?
Right. And I think what I like about how you broke that down is, as much of a revenge fantasy as it was, right, you point out all the obvious flaws, which overlooks the real heroism that took place. And it also contextualizes something that is just ridiculous, like one man is doing this whole thing. And you also point out that he doesn't even fight the power. He fights.
Right.
I mean, it's all these things that I have to go back and really think about again and be like, damn, based upon how you laid that out, it was like, holy snap, you know what? I really don't like that movie. On top of all the criticisms that you now pointed out with Tarantino, you know.
Yeah, and in a film, the person who dies last is the villain. That's the main villain. That's the person that dies last. In this film, in Django Unchained, Leonardo DiCaprio's character dies, but still, Jamie Foxx's protagonist has to fight against the so-called house slave that is played by Samuel L. Jackson. And so you, a white man, made a film about slavery in which the ultimate villain is a black man. Mm. That's just morally unconscionable.
And you know, there may be a little truth to it, but the real history that's obscured is the power structure that you talked about.
Bingo.
So now
like the problem isn't that he's a house slave. The problem isn't that he's a sellout slave. The problem is that he's a slave. It's like, yeah, you're justifying the way in which someone responds to an inhumane condition. You know, cowardice is the natural response to oppression. Most people in oppressive circumstance are going to respond in a fearful way.
Right.
And that no person of Quentin Tarantino's standing has the right to judge that.
We're talking with Jelani Cobb, author of a brand new book, Three of the Riot, and Notes of, what is the full title? Notes of How We Got Here.
Yeah. Three or More is a Riot.
Is a Riot, yeah.
Notes on How We Got Here.
Right, 2012 to 2025. So then you follow it up with Lincoln. And I mean, those two going back to back, and then you're doing a whole comparison with Obama and Lincoln. It is just filled with history after history. But then the Lincoln thing becomes very important too, with all the omissions by the most vaunted filmmaker, Steven Spielberg. And
sure.
So we go from Spielberg playing loose with facts and how it has a long-term impact to Steven Spielberg playing loose with facts and how that can have a long impact. And here we are in a nation that is trying to bury all the facts.
That's true. The interesting thing about Lincoln, right, is that I have always felt like there was an objective case for Lincoln's heroism. It just wasn't the case that people make. So people make this idea, this case of him being, you know, this benevolent emancipator who delivered freedom, you know, upon the benighted Negro population and so on, et cetera, et cetera. Even Lincoln didn't see it that way. You know, when questioned about this, you know, he said that he had made a deal, that he wanted to preserve the Union and the Negroes wanted freedom. And they had met, you know, as any two interested parties do. Like, let's find a way that we can collaborate and we will both get what we want out of this. He described it in very practical political terms. But if you wanted to make a case about Lincoln's heroism, it would have to be, you know, about the fortitude that he had, you know, where his own general turned against him and ran against him for re-election in 1864. His wife, you know, lapsed into despair, depression, and mental illness. His son died during the course of the war. He was tremendously unpopular. You know, people from every quarter said that he was doing the wrong thing, that he should just find a way to create peace with the Confederacy. He had this single-minded determination that it was like, no, the Union has to prevail. Can you imagine the type of fortitude it takes to have that kind of will in that kind of moment, to be that isolated and that criticized and still be able to see with clarity, you know, the direction that the nation has to move in? And when he writes that second inaugural address, which I give my students to read, you know, which is an astounding moral document, but he has that line in there where he says that the war, he talks about the morality of the Civil War. He gives this like this speech at the very end of the Civil War as he's being re-inaugurated. And he said that if it had came to be that every drop of blood that had been drawn by the lash had to be equaled by a drop of blood drawn by the sword, then the judgments of God are right and true. Mm. I was like, good God. This is a white man saying that if we have to shed as much blood as the Negro slaves have shed in the course of their bondage for us to be free of this situation, then that's just karma. And no, prior to that point, and really since, you have never heard a president grapple with the morality of that situation in those stark terms.
Absolutely. And at the same time, you make it clear that he was no angel.
No.
You know, and the critique of putting him as some sort of Jesus Christ figure is not only wrong, but you also point out in the movie, again, playing with the facts, you don't have your Thaddeus Stevens, you don't have the radical Republicans, you don't have Frederick Douglass agitating. And so part of Lincoln's history is the agitation of
that's
folks,
right.
To push him
into these positions. So the thing that I give credit to Lincoln about is that he was capable of hearing the people who were making these arguments.
Yeah.
I mean, because Lincoln started out as backward as could be. And you know, even at the end of his life, he was still backward, you know, about some of these things, including the idea of, you know, forced migration or black people getting emancipation and it being paired with us being dispatched to other places, including he considered Haiti, considered South America. He was like, okay, once they're free, what do we do to get rid of them? And, you know, Frederick Douglass has to correct him about that. Various, like, black voices have to correct him, you know, about that question. But then you have Thaddeus Stevens, who, you know, in that film really gets short shrift. You know, right. Lincoln, in every exchange they have, Lincoln seems smarter than him. He's kind of the person who outsmarts him. But Thaddeus Stevens understands what's going on here. You know, the one thing that I will say, which I didn't, you know, kind of retrospect, I didn't give Spielberg enough credit about, is that the film is actually a good distillation of how politics actually work. You know, of how even the best idea has to be subject to political process, which is, you know, I said like sausage being made.
But if you're leaving out and not fully reconciling with the history, and then looking at how you juxtapose this with Django, then you know, it's still like, nah, you know, I can't give you a pass on that, Spielberg.
Right. Because, no, you don't.
Because, you know, like you don't even say radical Republicans and what that means, right? And how influential they were. You know, you don't have Douglass in there, the whole nine, all these things that you pointed out. But one of the things that I thought was key, you know, and again, this comes back to what I was saying, is like each word in this book is not fluff. It's like, oh snap, let me check this out. You bring up the name Lerone Bennett, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And Lerone Bennett is like, I'm gonna say this, man, it's like, it seems like you're building off of where he left off. May he rest in peace.
Thank you.
Because the richness of his history, like Before the Mayflower is a must read. A must read because he unearths so much of that history. It's in his book that you hear about the meeting where Lincoln with black folks, and he's like, y'all need to leave the country. I'm like, what? I've never read that anywhere. You know, and he's giving you the footnotes and the whole nine. And that's just one of many things. And now I'm reading your book and it's like, oh yeah, boom, 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 boom. It's like, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I forgot about that. And in your case, you know, almost like with Lerone, obviously he wasn't in the room with a lot of things, but in much of your writing, you're in the room at these places. You're in South Carolina, you're in Sanford, you're in Ferguson, you're in all these places, you're in Moscow, you know, so you have this bird's eye view to couple with the history.
Mm-hmm. Can I just go back for a second and say, like, Debbie, how many of us were impacted by that book? I know we talk about like how many of us read, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X, and like our minds were never the same after that. But a lot of us finished the autobiography and went directly to Before the Mayflower. Like,
yeah,
that was on that same reading list. And I remember reading that when I was 19 years old. And there's just so much, you know, the fundamental history. You know, that was my real first grounding in the history of Black people. And importantly, he does go before the Mayflower because he gives us the history of those African states and the nations and empires that existed prior to us being kidnapped and subjected to the transatlantic slave trade. So, you know, implicitly making the point, our history does not begin in a slave ship. Right. We are human beings with culture and science and politics and, you know, families and all these things, you know, prior to that ordeal. And so I'm very happy to actually be able to make reference to that. And hopefully, you know, in my reference to him, you know, people will go back and actually look at that, you know, and you know, refamiliarize themselves with Before the Mayflower.
Well, that's why I say what you wrote is a continuation at an important moment in time. We don't have a lot of books that are grounded in recent history. You know, we often have to go back 50, 60 years, right? But here, in this period from 2012 to 2025, you know, you forget that, you know, Harry Belafonte passed and you do a whole thing on him. You forget about Ruby Dee, right? And you give a whole breakdown of that. So it's not, and it's not preaching history. It's like contextual. You forget a Mary Baraka, right? So I'm reading this and I'm like, whoa, you know, like, you know, and knowing that you are close with the family. So, you know, so there's this extra nuanced, you know, stuff. Reparations. So you and Ta-Nehisi Coates are good friends and you forget about that.
College classmates.
Right. Right. So I'm reading that and you're giving a whole breakdown of reparations, but it almost seems like an added, you know, like an addendum to what he wrote. So you got to read this to get this extra history. And then you go into a whole thing with Me Against the, you know, the title of his book was
Between the World and Me.
Between the World and Me. And then you do a whole thing on Ferguson.
Between the World and Ferguson. Yeah.
So it's like, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's almost like it in a hip hop way. It's like you're shouting out your colleagues. You're letting us know, like, this is a build. This is a continuation. This is a part of this much larger conversation that was started with other folks. So it's like, oh, wait, okay. I read Ta-Nehisi's thing. Now I'm reading your thing on reparations, and it just gives it extra, you know, extra meat to chew on.
Yeah, you know, can I go back to Mr. Belafonte for a minute?
Yeah.
You know, there's the thing. I never actually have told this story, you know, not publicly. But there was a time where I was on MSNBC, and I don't even remember what the topic was, but it was something that was going on, and they brought me on to talk. You know, invariably, if I'm on air, then, you know, someone's rights are being imposed upon. And, you know, I come off the air, I was in a car going back home, and I get this call. And it was from, you know, Mr. Belafonte's wife. And, you know, this was near the end of his life. You know, I knew he had been ill for a while. And she said, I just want you to know, Harry saw you on television tonight. You know, he said you did a great job, and to keep doing it, keep doing the thing that you're doing. And man, that's like the greatest thing. That's one of the things that, if you ask me, you know, about the most valuable interactions in my life. And I didn't even talk to him directly. His wife, you know, conveyed that on his behalf. And I was like, okay, Mr. Belafonte, you know, if when we look at him and what he did in his life and the risks that he took on behalf of his community and the stands that he took, you know, out of integrity, and if he thinks that I need to keep doing the thing that I'm doing, then yes, sir, I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
And to the point about history, I didn't know about the fallout with him and Hugo Chavez. You know, like, you covered that. I'm like, what? Like,
that's right.
And, you know, and you contextualize it in Belafonte's principles.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the one of the best lines was, you know, when he had been, like, early on, when you know, Obama had just come into office, and people still had that kind of afterglow, you know, electing a black president. And, you know, Mr. Belafonte was never enamored. You know, he was very critical from the outset. And there was a point where he and Obama, that Obama and Belafonte crossed paths, and I don't remember where they were, but he conveyed this story. He said, you know, Barack Obama said to me, you know, Mr. Belafonte, when are you going to cut me some slack? And, you know, Harry Belafonte said in like classic Belafonte fashion, he said, what made you think that's not what I've been doing?
Which is true. Obama, I mean, it's that's funny, but it is Belafonte.
Yeah.
But the Obama has a presence, even when he's not mentioned, but he is a major backdrop in this book. And you looking at him in, out, you know, contradictions, praise, the whole nine.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So he has a strong presence, but it leads us up, you know, because you pull no punches with the Trumpism, you pull no punches with George Floyd, so you are taking us up to 2025. But one, you know, Obama, you know, that whole situation, the parts in the book where you're giving these long history lessons about political parties, which I think is an absolute, like, every student needs to read this so you know this history. I mean, that's what I love about the book. It's like, man, we could just do a whole show. I might have to have you come back just to do a show on each chapter.
I appreciate that.
Just the history of the political parties and walking through it, looking at the ascension of Obama and some of the things that he's doing, the critiques that he's getting, all that. I mean, how are you balancing that? And you know these folks.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes you say things and it'll be awkward, but you know this too, because you've taken, you know, public stands and you've, you know, put questions to people that they didn't want to answer, and, you know, all of that. And I think that comes with the territory. And, you know, I talk with my students about that, saying that, you know, you have to be prepared. And so now I'm just very straight up with folk. I'll say, like, you know, we can be friends, we can be cool, we can interact, but I'm not going to pull any punches in anything. I wouldn't expect you to pull any punches about me. And those are the terms that we operate on, more or less.
So I mentioned Mary Baraka. You have a whole thing on Rachel Dolezal and the identification of blackness. You were at the Panther 50th anniversary, you know, all that sort of stuff. What stood out to you, if there was a part in the book that you want people to really focus in on, where you say, you know what, you get this book, read this, what would that be?
You know, there's a piece in there that I think, and this might be because of what's happening in the headlines right now, but there's a piece in there about the origins of the idea of states' rights.
Yeah.
And when we think about states' rights, we usually think about the Confederacy, or we think about segregationists and people who are defying the federal government. But what people don't know is that the idea of states' rights came from Thomas Jefferson, and he pioneered that theory as a means of protecting vulnerable immigrants, you know, because Thomas Jefferson was the founder of what was then called the Democratic Republican Party. Now it's the Democratic Party, but the Jeffersonian Democrats, people called. He was founder of that party, and his rivals, the Federalist Party, had passed laws to make it difficult for immigrants to be able to vote. And they did this because they knew the immigrants were going to vote for Jefferson and his party. And so in response, Jefferson has this idea that the states have the right to nullify federal laws that violate their freedom. And it becomes a controversial idea, but then it gets picked up, you know, on the verge of the Civil War by what, you know, what become the Confederate States. And when we look back, we're in that moment now. Look at what's happening in California. Look at what's happening in New York. What's happening in, you know, states around the country that are fighting against the federal government, specifically around immigration and the rights of people, of vulnerable immigrants.
Just remarkable. I'm just Jelani Cobb, I have a million questions. I forgot you did a whole thing on D-Nice in the quarantine. Stacey Adams in the fight for voting rights and all that. Elijah Cummings in Baltimore. I mean, you did not leave one stone unturned, but you do divide the book up into different parts. You have Winter in America. You have the Parameters of Hope. You have History Lessons. What was that about as we get ready to close out?
Yeah, so I just divided the book into like beginning, middle, end, or like a three-act play. You know, the things that I wrote in those first 4 years, which coincided with the second Obama term, the things that I wrote, you know, in the midst of the first Trump term, and then the things that I wrote in the Biden era leading into the second Trump administration. And I thought that those like bookends would be able to show the arc of how things evolved and developed, and to make true the subtitle, Notes on How We Got Here.
Are you surprised that we're at this moment now? Did you see this coming?
I'm not surprised. You know, I think I thought fairly early on in, you know, 2015, one of the things that people tend to overlook was that, you know, Dylann Roof killed those people in the church in South Carolina about 24 hours after Trump declared his candidacy for the presidency. And I don't think there's a cause and effect there, but I think that they were both expressions of the same zeitgeist. You know, one that was kind of redemptionist. And I say redemptionist not in the Christian sense, but in the white supremacist sense, the so-called redeemers that swept Black people out of being able to vote and installed segregation in the South. And so there was that kind of redemptionist idea around race.
Right.
That was, you know, surging at that moment. And I knew that it was going to end someplace bad. I didn't know that it would look like this. But, you know, this wouldn't, I think, have surprised me.
You know, did you have, were you consulted on doing stuff in the Smithsonian? I think both of us have done work, you know, at least on the hip hop side. So with you seeing them do this disruption, especially on the Black history side, what's your thoughts on that? How have you been feeling? Was this like your revenge? Like, oh, I'm going to put this history in a damn book. You ain't going to.
Yeah, that is.
You're not going to dismantle everything.
Honestly, I think that it is. You have to kind of institutionalize some things. But it reminded me that, you know, look, you know, Carter G. Woodson was the father of Black history, and he had to run from mobs, you know, during the race riot of 1919 in Washington, D.C. You know, he could have lost his life, you know, because of these mobs trying to drive Black people out of D.C. W.E.B. Du Bois, you had to go through segregated facilities trying to get to archives so that he could write the true history of the country. When you go back, it's important to read the books that these scholars produced, but it's also important to understand the circumstances that they produced them under. And so this field has been embattled. You know, the country has always been ambivalent about telling the truth about the entirety of its history. And so we would be naive if we didn't think that we would sooner or later have to grapple with this question again.
Jelani Cobb, I have a million more questions. So, you know, luckily I know you, so I can just ask you offline. But we're going to have you come on because, again, each chapter in this book is a lesson unto itself. I mean, we can dig deep, and I'm just looking at it, and I'm like, man, I wanted to ask you about this. I want to ask you about that. But I do want to remind people, on Thursday, October 16th, you'll be at City Arts in lecture. Mm-hmm. You'll be in conversation with John A. Powell out of Berkeley, and you'll be talking about your book, and so you'll be in the Sidney Goldstein Theater. So hopefully when you come to town, we'll catch up then. Any last thoughts you want to leave us with, either what is going on currently, what has happened, anything about the book? You know, the floor is yours for the next 30 seconds or a minute.
You know, I think that we have to really seriously, this history was produced for a reason. And that, you know, we weren't just supposed to study this history to feel good. It was produced so that we could understand it strategically. You know, what did we do in the dire, difficult moments that preceded this? What did we do to get through segregation? What did we do to try to put an end to lynching? You know, all of the things that we had to get the right to vote. We have to go back and study those things, not just in the abstract, you know, but to study them, I think, for the clues they give us about how we navigate the moment that we're in right now.
Real talk. And, you know, the other thing that I'm reminded of, we all had kids in this period of time. So I'm serious, you know, like when I get the official copy, you know, my kids is like, chapter for you, let's sit around this table and talk about it. Is this what you're going to do for your kids? Because we had kids around the same time.
Yeah, most certainly. The problem is that, like, because I'm their father, my kids are going to they have a hard time listening. So right. I might have to pull in some other stuff. You know, we'll get your collaboration with Jeff Chang, and they'll be more inclined to actually read that because it's not coming from their dad.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, yeah, it will be easier for me to. They don't want to read my book. My kids don't want to read my book. But they'll read yours.
So it's like that. It goes like that.
So we appreciate it. Dean Jelani Lerone Bennett Cobb. That is your name for now. You know, I'm putting that title on you because I think you build off the commitment to that history, important history at a time when things are being erased. Want to thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman, Chris Juwan, Cam. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right. Feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every obvious if they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat it and any from the steel grave beef. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, our neighbor to please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Let's go.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance
out. No more isolation. Break those bars. Hope is stronger than risen stars. Slams, no sunlight inside. 22 hours, nowhere to hide. Solitary justice, we call it pain. Pelican Bay to the Angola line. We in isolation, we reclaim time. Reclaim the time. This is the fight, breaking the night. Mandela rule. The world's on our side. In this torture, we won't be denied. In this torture, we won't be denied. In this torture, we won't be denied. Solid. Military cells is a sinister plan. Supermax prisons spread across the land. ICE detention. Isolate us and cause much pain. Different cages, same old chain.
Isolation, Cuba.
No more torture, dressed as time. Tear down the walls, let the people shine. No more isolation, no more cage.
Is that sorrow?
Turn that sorrow into righteous.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the